For Google searches, the company hopes users will use the internet they have even more. The deal comes as the U.S. and Cuban governments rush to finalize deals before Donald Trump's inauguration. The U.S. government has urged businesses to formalize deals with Cuba to make it more difficult for Trump to undo the improved relations with the country. For more global news headlines, visit talkmedianews.com.
You're listening to KXRY Portland, 107.1, 91.1 FM, streaming online everywhere at xray.fm. Welcome back to Group Therapy, our continued dialogue to come to grips with the current national and local reality. Each time at lunch, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, until the end of the year, which is perilously soon, we gather with friends and check in. How we doing? What have we learned? What do we need to learn? And what do we need to do? We want to hear from you. Feel free to call live, send a text, leave a voicemail. You can text in at 971-220-5979. That's 971-220-5979. You can call live when the line is open at 503-233-9729. It's open right now. That's 503-233-X-Ray. And if you have a thought, anytime you want, you can email us at morning@xray.fm. Today is the last show of the year. It's sort of a New Year's show, or it's sort of a this year, last year show, where we finally say goodbye to 2016. For many of us, this last year, with the loss of beloved cultural icons to election results, can be described, well, it says here, devastating. You pick your own adjective. On previous episodes of Group Therapy, we've discussed coping, family interaction, avoiding burnout. Today, one thing we're going to talk about is the healing power of humor. How can humor help us make sense of 2016, help us prepare for the coming year, which is next week? We'll also discuss the importance of building community to resist what might be coming. It's Friday. We'll also have our check-in with the Oregon ACLU, and we'll get a sense from our panelists what they hope to see a year from now if we were to get back together. Again, want to hear from you. Give a call, 503-233-9729, 503-233-9729, or send a text, 971-220-5979. If you have a thought on the healing power of humor, maybe it's a dumb joke. We would gladly accept texts of dumb jokes, or maybe not so dumb, or your own thoughts on the healing power of humor. Also on the importance of building community, let's take a moment to meet today's crew. We've got Sean Davis, writing instructor at Mount Hood Community College, Iraq War vet, recipient of the Purple Heart, former mayoral candidate, friend of X-Ray. Sean, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me here.
What has been your, key reflection, a closing thought for the year? Maybe a notable passing, for instance?
Oh, man, this year's been crazy. I can't wait for the new year to start.
Oh, yeah, because I'm sure it's getting better. That's the for all of you, I can't wait for 2016 to end.
Right? Yeah, well, you know, Bowie's not going to die again, so we got that.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and, Abe Vigoda really struck me because, he's been dead so many times. That was the joke. He's not dead. But then he's really dead this year.
So I haven't seen it. So apparently the BBC does a tracking of celebrity deaths based on how many of their pre-made obituaries they have to run. And for the first like 3 or 4 months of 2016, it was about 5x of 2012 and about 2x of the year before. So more deaths of notable people. So it wasn't just in our imagination or because of social media. It leveled off a little bit. We'll see a final count. I know it's morbid. We also have with us Dr. Alicia Moreland Capuya, Executive Director of OHSU's Avail Gordley Center for Healing. The first African-American native Oregonian to become a licensed and board-certified psychiatrist. Her website is dralishamorelandcapuya.com. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Closing thought for the year, a reflection, notable passing?
Absolutely. It's interesting we talk about the theme of healing, and I think there's the year has been challenging for some, and I think has presented opportunities for others. But I always say this to folks, and I want everyone to kind of bear it in mind. Just in life, we all live in what I call dichotomous states. You can literally, utterly be failing in one area of your life and thriving in another area of your life. But the general objective is for the trajectory to be up. So the question becomes, how do you thoughtfully navigate that space between realizing that it sucks and it also is great? That's what I'm hoping that we'd be able to encourage a little bit today. In terms of a notable passing, Carrie Fisher was a bit of a surprise to me, namely because of her being such a strong, staunch advocate for mental health awareness and herself being at the peak of vulnerability and letting everyone into the window of her own story and struggle, but also her triumph. And again, I want to focus on the struggle, but yet the triumph. So thank you for having me be here.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
You said it's been both, I forget the first word you used, something negative, and it's also been an opportunity.
It's been challenging and an opportunity.
What's the opportunity?
Well, the opportunity is this, and we're kind of getting into it. You know, many would make the argument that after the Civil War, we had the period of Reconstruction. And during that period, we had folks from the North and really well-intentioned folks from the South coming together. And that's where we got that was the birthplace for public education, mm-hmm. right? So some really good things came out of what felt like terror. Lincoln was dead. Many folks had died in this country, but some beautiful things came as a result. And so I think that even with the struggles or what feels like the fire and the rubble and the ashes, that it's going to be our goal to secure the beauty in those ashes. And there is, because there has been historically, and there will be moving forward.
Dr. Moreland Kapiu, thanks for joining us. Yep. We're also joined by Elizabeth Swartow, Program Director of the Oregon Motor Voter Neighbor to Neighbor Outreach Program. Interested and motivated in dismantling barriers of cultural capital as they relate to class, education, gender, and citizenship. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Closing thought for 2016, notable passing?
When you say notable passing, the first thing that comes to my mind sarcastically is like democracy, but maybe that's a bad joke. I'm actually...
Doesn't mean it's not true.
Doesn't mean it's not true.
Inaccurate.
I'm actually on board with the Carrie Fisher thing, and especially like thinking about one aspect of how she impacted, namely women, I really loved her attitude about aging. That's something that I've watched my mother deeply struggle with, and I think that she was really like, she was a pillar in a very forward-thinking way or attitude about that. So,
since I'll mention this, since this is the second time out of three that Carrie Fisher's brought up, partly because it's recent, I assume, but also I will say that we. X-Ray posted a picture of Carrie Fisher flipping off the camera, and that was the most viral picture we posted in months, right? It was like 600 likes, and everybody's, and I think not only because Carrie Fisher, but also it sort of felt like an interesting, maybe relevant sentiment for the end of the year. But you also worked, I think, on passing something in a different way. This was the first year for Oregon Motor Voter in the automatic voter registration for the first time, and you're probably feeling somewhat proud of that.
I am feeling proud, and I think that it's good to remember that we also had a lot of local wins. And then, you know, for my program specifically, it's pretty amazing that we were able to talk to almost 2,000 folks here in the Portland area and then as well out in Bend. And we had something like almost 80%, you know, say that they were going to vote, and then on the other end of that, a large portion of those folks actually did go out and vote. And just having those conversations were, you know, on election day and then post-election day, a reminder like all is not lost.
So one of the questions was when you passed new motor voter was, so these people be automatically registered. Will they even know? Will they even care? Will they even show up? And so you did some work to let them know and remind them.
Yeah.
And it turned out that something like 90 plus thousand people cast, you know, new votes, got new ballots got cast, something like that.
In that range. And I think that is a good thing to note about that law. I mean, it was a huge part of the work that we were doing to say, hey, you are registered. A lot of these folks didn't even know. However, you know, they were intending to vote, but a lot of these folks were like not expecting to get their ballot in the mail, expecting to go to a poll. So it was definitely revealing that we need to have some kind of system in place for folks that are new to Oregon and not used to our ways. And I think this program was really just the beginning of that. And the law in general, I say this over and over again, is a great model for what the rest of this country can do. And then our program is a little offshoot of that. It was really exciting.
Thanks for being here. We're also joined by Tom Johnson, founder and artistic director of the Brody Theater, a regular here on X-Ray. You can find out more about them at brodytheater.com. How about you, man? First of all, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me back. It's good to be here.
Are you glad about the closing of 2016 or dreading the start of a new year?
I always dread the end of the old year because my birthday is December 31st and everyone has a big party and it's not about me.
But, you have a New Year's Eve birthday?
Yeah.
How do you handle that? Do you just go to somebody else's party? You host your own, call it a New Year's Eve party? What do you do?
We do a show at my theater.
Good
and
plug.
Then I go home. Get off the streets. Get out of downtown.
What's the show this year?
It's our traditional New Year's Eve show. It's called A Very Brody New Year, and it's a variety show where we showcase a lot of the things that we do at the Brody, which includes improvisation, stand-up comedy, and sketch comedy. And we'll have an appearance by our friend, former senator-elect and failed presidential candidate Dixon Ticonderoga. He's
nice.
Going to give his year-end speech and assessment of the state of his state of our union.
Dixon Ticonderoga has made a few star turns here at X-Ray, I know.
He has.
Let me ask the whole panel, are you guys interested in to close the show perhaps singing Happy Birthday to Tom Johnson? You guys down to do a little singing?
Definitely.
Dr. Yeah. Moreland Capullo, singing is what you were hoping to get into today when we booked you for this program?
I'll hum a little bit.
Just backup humming?
Backup humming.
Just a little bit of bass humming?
I practiced, actually.
Tom, wanted to finish with you so we could start with you. Healing power of humor. This has been often a downer of a set of discussions, and somewhat intentionally so, hopefully honestly so. And not only, hopefully we also embrace Dr. Moreland Capullo's take of what are the opportunities that face us in the coming year and coming years. But this is a chance also to, given the current political climate, to evaluate the question of, is laughter in fact the best medicine? Is it too soon? What role should comedians play in the age of Trump and a Trump Congress?
Yeah, that's something that's really been on my mind the last few months, and especially now. To me, I look at comedy a couple ways. One is that just sort of by definition, it is therapeutic. That is, it's been proven it's good for you to laugh, and the comedian's job is to get up in front of people and stimulate them intellectually to make this, you know, funny sound involuntarily that makes them feel better. If you then look, though, at that the content, that's, to me, where it gets important, because I truly believe comedy and laughter is therapeutic, but to me it's not about about it being a diversion from or an escape from what's going on in your life or in society. It's rather a route into it. It's a different route into it than what the so-called serious. To me, I mean, my philosophy, if I have one, is that funny is not the opposite of serious. It's another way in. And maybe a way out the other end, which involves, you know, catharsis. The laughter can be the kind of catharsis, kind of the opposite.
Yeah, so there's at least two parts here, right? There's the sort of civic discourse side, and then there's kind of the at least two parts of this, and the civic discourse side, and then also kind of the emotional, psychological impact on the single given human being. And you sort of flag both of them. I want to take them in turn. I want to, Dr. Moreland Capullo, what might listeners not know, or maybe what should they know about the therapeutic nature of humor? Why does it matter?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Humor is very important, as has already been pointed out, because it actually does have a physiologic sort of effect on us in terms of healing and releasing good sort of hormones and pheromones, and those are very important. But also, it does cause many to be in a reflective space, and that to be thinking about what one can do or should do in the context of what we call either coping versus a defense mechanism. And many people use humor as a coping mechanism, and that's a conscious process. So it's how we make our way and navigate through tough spaces. But also the goal at the end is to survive. And then there's a defense mechanism, which is an unconscious process, which are the things that we do that impact us, the environment, and how we sort of act things out as a consequence of what we heard, right? So I appreciate the point that was made about the content and also the reaction from that content, because it turns out that jokes they do matter in terms of what we hear, because they do shape the conscious, whether it's a conscious process or unconscious process, and that's very important. But it is helpful, it is useful, and to the extent that we can be educating people to take the pain or the power from that comedy to propel us towards some great solutions, I think that's going to be key moving forward in 2017 and beyond.
So here is a historical exegesis, historical analysis that is simplistic, and yet I hold to it with great pride. A response to the Vietnam War was folk music. A response to the Reagan era was punk. A response to the Bush era was comedy. And I find it interesting that not only art comes and in the wake of national stress, but for me the question then is, what should come? What makes the most sense? And even looking backwards, what has been most useful? The thing I find interesting is that it seems like folk was a thing that more likely led to somebody taking the current situation seriously and doing something about it and showing up for a protest, certainly more than punk, and maybe more than Jon Stewart, right? Jon Stewart said, oh yeah, let's tease this stuff, call Donald Trump a dum-dum, and by the way, you know what critique doesn't work, apparently? Calling Donald Trump a dum-dum, or calling Ronald Reagan a dum-dum, or calling George W. Bush a dum-dum. Turns out calling him a dum-dum, I don't know how persuasive that is. In connecting with people about what they think the world needs to look like. Anybody got a favorite art form, what they hope we do with art or comedy going forward?
You know, what you said about the 60s and the 80s, I mean, I had a note here in front of me, but there were also comedy booms in the 60s and 80s. And if you think of Vietnam and the Nixon era, and you think of comedy, and you know that history or were around, you think of the Smothers Brothers, who came out of the folk scene, but stand-up comedy, as we know it now, developed out of the folk scene on the West Coast.
Boom.
And they were, they got a TV show, which was not politicized, but it became so during the war, and they were literally thrown off the air. They were fired by the network on a technicality of their contract, but the reason was they were fighting censorship, and they were continuing to criticize the war, and Nixon had a lot of friends who ran the network, and he sure didn't like them, and he sure was involved with something being done about it.
Certainly George Carlin came up during that time. Keep going.
Yeah. Well, and in the 80s, there was a huge comedy boom. That's when I started. We're in one now. It's even bigger, but the biggest one that had ever happened was in the 80s, and it was kind of in the middle of the middle to late Reagan years when things were coming home to roost. You know, the damage that was being done and the disillusion, or the people who just sort of sat there and took it for his first term, were starting to have more to say, and that included comedy. There was an enormous boom in comedy clubs all over the place. I was in Chicago when it happened, and we went from one stand-up club within the city limits of Chicago and a couple in the suburbs to six or eight 10 in the 12 in the suburbs and a comedy night at every other bar in town. So there's a reason that comedy booms happen, and it's societal and it's political.
And they were responding to certain problems. Remember, was it Robin Williams and Whoopi Goldberg? They were helping out with the homeless situation and they have a huge benefit shows.
Yep. Dr. Mullen-Capu, you were going to say
something. As we think about sort of current day, we think about sort of what people are hungry for, and I think of the Trevor Noahs and the Stephen Colberts, that they're looking not just for the humor, but they're also looking for the analysis. What's the analytic aspect of it, and how does this move us forward? I think everyone's trying to figure out what can I do, and that it presents a rich opportunity, so that comedy, in essence, is one potential birthplace for action and for moving forward.
Yeah, it's speech, and it's often a form of protest, but it's expression. And as you said, Jefferson, you were kind of talking about that dichotomy between personal expression, personal reaction, and maybe societal or commentary. And comedy is both. But to me, it's no matter what you're doing, it's by definition social commentary, because it's a performer or performers expressing themselves through comedy, but what they're expressing themselves about are those individual issues, being human or being a citizen, or societal issues, what's going on around me and how am I reacting to it.
Yeah, I mean, just I really echo a lot of things that y'all are saying, and I'm also thinking a positive side about what happened with how we tried to make a joke out of Trump, and it turns out the joke was on us, is I think that it puts us into a place where we're going to start thinking a little bit more seriously about how we use humor. Mm-hmm. And our comedians or whoever those voices are that are using humor are hopefully going to take on a little bit more responsibility. And, you know, I always say a joke is a death of a thought, and I think that that's becoming more and more true.
Say more.
Well, I guess my last point would be... I lost it. But yeah, I just think
joke is a death of a thought.
Joke is a death of a thought. I just think that we need to use it a little bit more responsibly, and now it's coming back to me where I think comedy can also be used in a negative way where we become desensitized to certain things because they become something that we're laughing about. And whether that's a person or whether that's a social problem, we need to look at that in a way that's more constructive.
Tom?
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, that question is out there for all of us involved in comedy. I mean, we're not the only ones that the joke is on, but we're a part of that, you know, of this society that the joke was on. So how are we going to use that joke? How are you going to rewrite that one in the next 4 years? And there's certain things that you can't do. For example, fake news used to be a form of comedy. Sometimes it's just simple parody, making fun of a commercial or a TV show or something, or making fun of the news. But
no, that's what we call the Onion, right? Yeah, that was the thing. It was like to be a joke, not to elect a president.
Right. But it also was a form of I think, commentary and expression. And now it's become co-opted as a political weapon of the right. So we've got to look elsewhere and say, okay, what are we going to do? We have work to do is the way I look at it.
You know, I teach community college, and I'll tell you, all my students get their news from Trevor Noah, from John Oliver, you know, and it is big. It's a huge thing, and it could be dangerous. They'll fall for the fake news. And as far as, you know, news being funny, look what the New Yorker did. I hadn't seen it ever before. They do onion-like articles. The last one was about Ivanka Trump and global
warming.
Andy
Borowitz, right? Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
But at this point, the absurdities become the norm, and it's not the first time that's happened, but that's what's going on. And if that's the case and you're involved in comedy of some kind, you have to look at, okay, how do I express myself now when the ridiculous, surreal, insane stuff is what's happening and what's out front? It's a challenge.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's interesting, though, because what we are terming or deeming ridiculous and insane, most folks think is normal and respectable.
For instance.
So this issue of context being everything, you know, I used to think that if you are genuine, if you are true, if you actually fact-checked, that people actually care about that. And it turns out that there's a large contingent out there that doesn't always pay attention to those things. It turns out that people feel more than they actually see or actually are cognitively in tune with. So people aren't looking to be touched with the brain. They're looking for you to touch them somewhere in the heart. And even if that means that you are speaking, it means sort of speaking in simple terms and simple ways that they feel like they can reach and attain. So it for me, this election felt like someone said that it was... that this election represented the intellectual rot of this country. That, those aren't my words. I just took those words from someone, actually, I think off of a Fox News network, to say the least. And this was the right, basically giving feedback to the right. And I think that that's something that we have to also bear in mind, is that who is the audience? Who are we trying to inspire? Who are we trying to educate? We know that education doesn't always change behavior. In this country, nothing in history has ever changed amidst comfort and convenience, nor has it ever changed with just education alone. So if comedy is one vehicle that we want to use or employ as we move forward in 2017 to help inspire change and to educate a whole new cadre of folks, hence the millennials, and inspiring them to do work, what does that look like? What should that look like?
What do you think it looks like?
Well, I think it looks like tweets, and I think it looks like social media, and I think it looks like bite-sized things that help move people. So the things that people are moved by, it tends to be these less intellectual things. So we're given historical context here on this show, and that's important. And then it's also important to say things that they sort of get, like the new rap song that's out that speaks to these political issues, or, you know, so it's trying to reach people.
And I agree on the reach people. And one of the themes that has come up as we've been doing this series of discussion, which for people who have listened to a bunch of them might be able to see the arc. And one of the brain coach Brad really hit it a bunch was cognitive dissonance and the backfire effect, right? Mm-hmm. That we have an argument, and if there is a dissonance of fact, our brain brain will will come up with a way to have it comport with our preconceived idea, and then and relatedly that our frontal lobes won't process what our reptilian brain won't allow. And at the same time, oh, go ahead. You want to say something?
Oh yeah, no, I'm just saying. That's what you're talking about. That's actually default. All human beings default to back to what's comfortable and what they understand. And this idea of the prefrontal cortex not being predominant and people going back to what we call the primitive brain, that's actually trauma and stress. And mm-hmm. that's a whole nother discussion. Mm-hmm. But we have so many people out there operating in a stressful environment that they don't have the privilege of being able to access the cognitive prefrontal cortex of their brain. And that's another very real reality.
And I want to talk about community building and how we think, as you're saying, Dr. Moreland Capuya, that we might have the going to where people are, something that they already care about, something they already recognize, or thinking about a place like the Brody Theater as a place where community building happens, or Sean, thinking about your students a place where young people are convening to learn stuff is the Daily Show, right? Is now Trevor Noah, used to be Jon Stewart. And I still have questions about what are the opportunities there and what are the limits there. But let's talk a little about community, and I'll segue this way. Just today, there was a story posted by one of my Mormon relatives that said California Democrats vote to legalize child prostitution. Okay, and it turns out what the story was that California passed a bill so that victims of child sex trafficking would be treated as victims instead of as criminals. So, for instance, like I, call my own play here. I worked on passing the first bill in Oregon on human trafficking. It was a modest little bill to include a notice in OLCC licensed establishments of a telephone number so that people could, so women in experiencing human trafficking could call somebody and get help. And one of the reasons, according to experts and studies, that women and girls didn't call was because they were worried they would get in trouble. And so changing it so that the legal responsibility would be on Johns, would be on victimizers, would not be on child sex trafficked, was a really important thing. California just passed that bill. The headline that was spread around by some set of websites was California Democrats vote to legalize child prostitution. And I will say that I normally respond, I normally try to take Brain Coach Brad's and Dr. Alicia Moreland Capuya's advice and first listen and agree to find some place of empathy and agreement before I launch into my own viewpoint. I will say that I was imperfect in this context and I did not offer an introductory sentence or two of agreement and empathy and laid into what I think it was a horrific use of misleading information. Sean, you wanted to talk about community and yeah. How do we think about building community here? We talk about community, and very intentionally so, with people who share a disappointment in the Trump presidency. That doesn't mean that's how it's going to happen after the end of the year. This is something we decided to do until the end of the year. But how do we think about community building within people who agree, but also beyond people who agree?
Yeah, you know, I think about this a lot. You know, I run the American Legion post, and you think about the American Legions, the VFWs, the Eagles Lodges. There is a stigma for joining those institutions now. Mm-hmm. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be, you know, you're trying to be a part of your community, and this is your responsibility to do that. How do we get people today how do we get rid of that stigma? I mean, I think a lot of it is reaching out. We talked about reaching out to millennials, and we're talking, you know, I'm a critical thinker.
I think Elizabeth is one.
I'm a critical thinking.
I have a friend who's a millennial,
and I teach critical thinking, and I think of more along the lines of the art of argument had ethos, pathos, and logos, and today all we're talking about is pathos.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know, how do we get the ethos and logos in there? How to have people to pay attention to it? You know?
Quick to find those terms. A lot of people know them. Some people could be reminded.
Yeah, ethos is like the appeal to credibility. Pathos appeal to emotions. Humor is one of them, of course. And logos, it's appeal to logic. And so we're just, you know, right now, but if we look at the news sources as well, they're always appealing to pathos. You know, you see very little logic. You see very little credibility anymore. But you'll mm-hmm. see somebody, you know, how does Obamacare affect you? We'll wheel out the family that was crushed by it. They're crying their eyes out. Later on, it turns out they're not even affected by it really, but we don't care because we saw them crying, so we're upset, you know.
Well, it's clicks, right? I mean, when we know we know that the thing that gets to the prefrontal corpus,
I call it the sweet spot.
I say the reptilian brain. The real term is?
It's the primitive brain. So it's the brainstem and the limbic system. But
the limbic system. system. That was what I was looking for. Yeah.
But we're
and that's what gets us to click. If it gets to our limbic system, if it just teaches us something and it doesn't get enough of a synaptic connection to give us a little bit of dopamine, then we're less likely to click share.
Yeah, and you don't want to read the longer article, you know. I understand how it is, but I mean...
So how do we get there?
How do we get there? Yeah, I guess this is what the conversation is,
I mean,
right?
But that's a longer... What we
have we only have like 12 minutes for this, so we got to solve it all right now.
I understand,
doctor.
But what we kind of have to go back to is sort of our current education system right now.
Yeah, definitely.
Right now, what Oregon is like at the very bottom in terms of our how we educate young kids and even in our early childhood efforts. So I think it gets back to... How do we set folks up to be conditioned to learn from the environment and with each other and to be curious? What I have seen is that folks just aren't as curious anymore. That curiosity has been scorched with the need to survive. And so let's think about why people are in survival mode. Poverty is on the rise. Folks are working 2 and 3 jobs trying to make a living. Healthcare is expensive. Racism, discrimination, sexism, misogyny are on the rise. So people are in a stage, in a state of survival. You talk about the primitive brain. People are like, I'm just trying to make it through this next minute. And so because I'm trying to make it through the next minute, again, I literally don't have the privilege of being able to be logical and to really think before I act sometimes. Mm-hmm. And even though I should, so it's a little harder. So I think we have to pair what our expectations are with what the current realities are.
So let's accept that as reality. Let's accept that as reality, yeah. And then ask a couple questions, assuming that is shared reality, and agreed upon truth. Therefore, what is the lesson for the activist?
The lesson for the activist is to find opportunities and ways to lower stress. So how do we work to reduce the likelihood that women are living in poverty? What causes do we attach ourselves to ensure that houselessness is less of an issue? Right. Mm-hmm. So there are some very real things that can be done and policies that are worked on. I mean, I can give names of many things, a home for everyone. What can you do for that?
Right.
Working with specific clinics, community behavioral health clinics, and volunteering your time. What can you do for that? Can you go to a school and volunteer your time? If you're good at science and math or reading, can you go and volunteer for an hour at a school and help a child learn how to read? There are some very specific things that we can do today. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be person by person. The change is going to happen. As I say, change really happens from person to person and at kitchen tables.
Yeah,
right?
I agree. You know, at my community center that I took over, we doubled the membership there. And then this is how we
Good
do
plug.
It. It is at Post 134 on Albert Street. This is how we do it. We show people, like, hey, you want to come and help us out? This is the direct action to you helping.
Right.
This person got a sleeping bag. These people right here are going to be able to get food this week.
Right.
And showing them that and showing that individual level, not just looking at the bigger picture, you know, I think it makes a lot of difference if you're just doing one or two things in your neighborhood, yep, as opposed to like I have to do this huge thing and not doing anything at all.
Right.
That was Sean Davis. You were also just before that listening to Dr. Alicia Moreland Capuya. We're also here with Elizabeth Swartow and Tom Johnson. I'm Jefferson Smith. We are at our last show of the year, the last group therapy of the year. We're going to be thinking about, particularly after January, what makes sense to do with this time, how to address this sort of what have we learned question, what do we need to do question, how can we best serve our mission, serve the community. If you have thoughts, feel free to text in at 971-220-5979. It's 971-220-5979. In just a moment, we're going to be joined by Matt DeSantos from the ACLU. But before we do that, Tom, any thought you have on connecting the conversation we are having with humor and connecting the conversation we are having with community building, and then connecting also the good doctor's comment on how do we address stress and safety to allow people to get past their address concerns of safety before they're engaging in logos and ethos?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, about community, and you mentioned that, you know, that the Brody Theater is a form of community. We build community there. That's why I'm involved in comedy at this level and in this way. You know, our audience is in the room with us, and we're experiencing this together. They're not at home passively watching television, and we may address the same similar issues or do comedy in similar or different ways, but it's different if you're there, because it's a place that people come to be together and to see a show, have a good time, we hope. But we're all going through what we're going through together, and what happens on our stage, it's either stand-up comedy or it's improvisation, which is literally improvised, strict dictionary definition of the word, the way we do it, or it's sketch comedy that was written by and about each other and what we're going through. And I think that that experience of witnessing it together and the effect that the audience has on the performers and vice versa is a community. And it's to me also it can be a form of healing. I mean, you might get people to focus on something because it's funny, it makes them laugh, they feel good, they think it's clever or it appeals to them, but maybe somewhere in there, and I'm not saying everything has to be this, but it often is, maybe somewhere in there it's about something. There was a well-known comedian and writer, Bob Odenkirk, was at the theater last weekend, and he was critiquing some sketches by some of our students, and a couple of them were very overtly political or filled with social commentary, and he was talking to the writers of those sketches as we workshopped them and saying that you need to back off with this, not that you need to avoid the issue, but that his phrase was you need to put it in there like a secret bomb, so the people they're going to get it, but they're going to get it in a different package. They don't have to approach it the way they have to approach the rest of their life, which can be very stressful in these times.
And I'll connect a couple dots. What we've seen, and Elizabeth also involved in New Voter Voter was the bus project, and the basic idea of that youth organizing was face-to-face communication, in-person community building kind of politics. And the rise of the bus project was the same time as the rise of MoveOn.org, almost to the month. Mm-hmm. And MoveOn.org was click and do something. MoveOn.org got really, really big. A hypothesis I've had is that, maybe not a theory yet, but a hypothesis I've had is that the click can get you, and the thing that you read quickly can get you to feel a particular thing, get you to act in a particular way. It is the community that brings you back. It's the community that gets you to go to the sixth meeting when the emotional charge of the anger that you felt or the fear that you felt or the hope that you felt or the agreement nod that you did briefly has passed, and all of a sudden you've got to fill the 1,000th envelope or recruit the 72nd canvasser or give the, make the 122nd phone call, that it is the community that keeps you coming back. It is the positive peer pressure. It's that relationship. How do you think we have to use, you're working on neighbor to neighbor, how do we have to use neighbored communities and build community to get people coming back, not only to click one time?
Well, I think it's about actually taking people that truly live in those communities and having leaders within those communities and doing it in a sort of almost mosaic way. And here's the truth. When we were knocking doors for this program, we were not only targeting the newly registered voters, but we were also targeting low propensity voters. And I'll tell you what. I could almost immediately guess whether it was a new voter or whether it was a low propensity voter. Wow. New voters were oftentimes living in, single family homes, nicer units, better upkeep. They were a lot of times people that either were moving around within Portland and had the means to do that or new to Portland altogether. Low propensity voters were people that were clearly living in more multifamily unit homes, yeah. Homes of poor upkeep, like the ones that I grew up in. and that was something that was just so optically impactful for me when I was doing this work and very impactful for my staff. And
so what do we do with that information?
What we do with that information is I think we take the people that are from these lower income homes and we give them a space to claim their own power. Because when you actually got into conversations with these folks, maybe they didn't know everything that was on the ballot, but they had a lot of things that they cared about. There was a lot of things that impacted them. They had, jobs where they were working a lot of hours. There's a lot of legislation right now, and I'm sort of in the mind of the state because I'm about to work for State Senator Michael Denbro. A lot of
good
legislation
plug.
That's going to, thanks, that's going to impact these folks. And I think that if yeah, if we create a space for them to claim their own power.
This, and we got to get to Matt DeSantos of ACLU in just a second, but this, it seems like we're getting towards the hard part. That, let's say, I want to take what Sean Davis is saying as truth, okay? That we've got to build community if we want to do anything about this. And
right.
I also want to take what Dr. Moreland Capuia was saying as truth, which is if you are not coming from as much of a place of advanced privilege, that having lots of extra time and space to do extra community building is a harder set of choices. And and if I take those together, okay, then what? What are the places for community building that fit within people's lives, that help address basic needs, or at least don't get way in the way of addressing basic needs, and at the same time build the kind of fellowship that helps us recognize we're stronger together than we are apart, helps us recognize we can solve each of our own problems together. And by the way, that has been at times during the progressive movement, the church, also during the rise of the right wing, Christian movement, also the church. It has been the Union Hall. It has been the VFW Hall. What are other places that we can look to build community and not just sneer at that kind of stuff, but to say, no, that kind of stuff is the answer. Anybody?
I'm going to further muddy the water and say that
multiple
things can be true at the same time.
Sure.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact of the matter is though, I think that where we struggle these days is that not everyone has a shared understanding or agreement on what community is and how we define it. And I feel like we kind of need to get to that place. I am of the mind that we actually need to move back towards those places that helped us back during the Civil Rights Movement and in the points of Reconstruction, that the church actually should become more central, that places like the VFW should be central, because everyone is looking, as I say, every human being, including everybody in this room who are human beings, we all desire two things, to be understood and to be connected. And so when you are given an opportunity for that, then that's where that's the birthplace for community. So there are some structures already in place. So why you know, duplicate effort when there are opportunities already for this particular community building?
I will take that as a question and not as a rhetorical one.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think it's a yes and, right? So I think the church
both
can
and.
Be and is a place. I think that the VFW Hall is a place. Not everybody's a veteran. Right, and
true.
not everybody believes that Jesus Christ is the Son of God.
And I don't think you have to believe that in Jesus to be at a church to volunteer.
But there might be people who want civic options that lie alongside their belief system a little more closely. So that's not to say people shouldn't gather at churches. Churches can be a wonderful place to build community. And I would also say, what else in addition?
Well, you have the American Legion, where you don't have to all be a veteran. You can have a beat related to Eagles Lodges, Elks Lodges, Weird Fellows.
And let's take those, right? Because we started the bus project with the idea in mind of the fraying social fabric. And somebody says, why don't we just restitch the old thing that we had? And one of the reasons, and I would say yes, and I would say one of the reasons was lots of those institutions
fighting the change. I know. Yeah. I'm running up against it myself.
And are like if somebody maybe in this conversation wants to fight the patriarchy, the Eagles Lodge is a hard place to do it.
Right? Oh yeah. Well, I'm doing it right here in the American Legion. I mean,
right.
You have to be. I know we're under a time crunch. You have to be either a veteran, a spouse or a veteran, or a son or daughter of a veteran. Right now, the Marines have more progressive outlook on sexual orientation membership than we do as American Legion, and that's insane.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to fight it, but I'm fighting it on a national level. We built up this bureaucracy. American Legion is the biggest veterans group in the United States, and it has a big voice on Capitol Hill, but it's dying. It went from 14,900 membership posts across this country to 13,200 in 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's slowly dying, but it's wondering why. And it's because we need to give leadership roles to younger people. We have to. When I took over that place, I had to fight to get Wi-Fi because they thought it was a passing fad. You know, I mean, these are serious things. I mean, we're talking about how do we incorporate.
So update. So one thing is updating and refurbishing and just re-getting engaged in older institutions. Anybody want to add to our list of other places to build community in addition to the things that have been mentioned?
But also updating and refurbishing our perception of what certain structures have been.
Yeah.
I think that also has to be
on the
table. For example, the church. There are many open-minded folks who are accepting and loving at the real church, so it's a microcosm of the world. And so if we're thinking about I think that it has to, that all things should be up for grabs. I mean, when you say other places, it's hard for people to name other places, because then we're getting into, oh, come to a community meeting. A community meeting where?
No, this is my point. Yeah. If you say the only answer.
I'm not saying the only answer, I'm saying one of many, and
nobody's disagreeing with that, but what I'm wanting to nudge your brain on, and what I'm hoping will nudge all of our brains on, is what are the new places?
Well, I think there aren't that many.
Right. And so that I don't think therefore the answer is we shouldn't figure them out.
There's some opportunities for innovation. So
there
to
you
create,
go.
But you
any
have
ideas for
to
them?
But you have to be thinking about how we define community.
Elizabeth, any thoughts for new places?
Well, you know, I think the best place to start is actually with the self. I think that up until now, and actually still now, community is sort of like a white liberal feel-good word. And I think that we need to change our ideology about what it means and say that, you know what, community is actually something that takes a lot of grit, and it takes a lot of bravery, and it takes the willingness to spend what little free time you may have to be in a room with people that dramatically disagree with you, and finding commonalities in that. And I think that that's something that everyone in this country is beginning to reflect on, I hope, and why, you know, these conversations are so important.
If you have thoughts, feel free to text in 971-220-5979, 971-220-5979, of examples. We've heard the church, we've heard the Union Hall, we've heard the VFW Hall, we've heard the Comedy Club. We haven't heard yoga.
Neighborhood associations
we heard. Are there things that we should do with existing institutions to reinvest in them to help them build community better? Are there new institutions that should be built? That's a good topic. Let's talk to Matt Dos Santos with a few minutes for ACLU's Year in Review. Matt Dos Santos, thanks for your patience. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. Good conversation.
You have a take on that conversation? Anything ACLU or you personally are working on to build community either within an existing organization or with something that's a little more nascent?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, I think that all the things that folks were saying, you know, they resonated with me. But I think that also you turn to organizations like the ACLU and others here locally, as well as, you know, that have a nationwide footprint, and look towards the sort of outreach and community organizing that folks are doing, because, you know, a lot of times community doesn't exist within four walls. It can be at an event that happens just on, you know, a single day. It can be at when you're meeting with legislators on lobby day, which I'll talk about, and things like that. So, I think that for me personally, and sort of what I've been encouraging folks to be thinking through as they are looking for ways to get engaged and get through this grief, is, you know, to have an expansive view of community. And to not just look at the sort of traditional notions that may no longer serve us.
Yeah, I think we might have consensus in this conversation of an expansive view, and also a return to some shared understanding, as well as expanding that understanding. Pivoting kind of with a hard pivot to the ACLU's Year in Review, big thoughts looking back at this year or looking ahead at next year, Matt?
Well, you know, I think that it was... It was sort of nice putting this together and to reflect on this, because I thought to myself, gosh, you know, there were, you know, of course, Oregon has this progressive liberal reputation, and there were a number of things that happened in Oregon in 2016 that were not great, right? Like everything from, you know, the surveillance of folks using the hashtag Black Lives Matter by the, you know, Oregon's very own Department of Justice, you know, revelations about Multnomah County and beyond, where we saw, you know, African Americans and other minorities being incarcerated at times like, you know, six times higher than the rates of other folks, or white folks rather, in Multnomah County. And so I thought to myself, you know, wow, so we are actually always engaged in this conversation, right? And there's this old adage that we hear at the ACLU a lot, which is like, there are no new civil liberties issues. We just revisit them all the time. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a little bit of hope, because I put it into context. I'm like, okay, so we are engaged in this fight, and we've been engaged in this fight for some time. And now we are going to have to just sort of, I think in some ways, just continue the fight, but maybe with new strategies. So that's, I think, my takeaway, which is like to find hope in the fact that this struggle is ongoing.
Dr. Moreland Kapuya, any take on the year looking backward, the year looking ahead through a civil rights lens, through an understanding that a lot of this isn't new stuff. A lot of this stuff is refocusing on stuff we hope we know a little bit.
Sure. Again, what it's going to take, you know, I've made this argument, you know, my appeal is to the hearts and then the mind, and that is that change happens at kitchen table. So the question becomes, how do I convince my loved one across the table from me, who may think different from me, to get to a place of what I call a point of convergence, where we can at least agree that that we all know what it feels like to suffer. We all know what it feels like to have pain and to have loss. And if those things draw us together, then what other things might we be able to agree upon?
So how do you approach that actually? Imagine you're at the kitchen table, right? How do you actually do that? How do you recommend other people do that?
So part of the question that I typically ask people is there anybody in this room who's never been afraid? It's a double negative. Is there anybody who's on this show with me who's never been afraid?
Here.
You've never been afraid?
Kidding.
Right. I was about to say, well, then I would love to speak with you. You would be so everybody,
right?
Everybody knows what it's like to be afraid, right? To be fearful, to be afraid of something. And so that's where we start. It's sort of, that's like the point of principled negotiation. So because now you and I have a shared understanding of what it is like to be afraid, then let's explore what other things we might be able to agree upon. And that's the beginning of the conversation.
Start of place of commonality, start with a place of agreement.
Place of agreement. Yeah. And it works wonders.
Matt DeSantos, who are the biggest adversaries of the ACLU right now? I mean, I know in the 80s, like being a card carrying member of the ACLU was a term of derision in a lot of pop culture circles and a lot of media circles. Who right now is coming after you?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of that has stayed the same, right? Like, I think that the sort of card-carrying member of the ACLU...
Do you have to carry a card? Do you actually send out cards? That's a question I have.
We do. We do. And if you don't have one, you can get one by just becoming a member. I think it's, like, the cheapest gift you can give. It's, like, $5.
What kind of discounts do I get?
Like,
what kind of discounts? Do I get rewards points? Like, any time, like, I recognize injustice, do I get, like, ACLU rewards points that I can redeem for cash and prizes later?
I am so open to this idea.
We ought to talk about it. Take it offline.
Denny's breakfast.
Yeah.
really, is Denny's the place? Of all the places you want to plug, that's the spot? At Brody Theater, you get free tickets to Brody Theater if you get 72 justice points. what are the key fights that you see going ahead, Matt DeSantos of the ACLU, if that is your real name?
Yeah. So I mean, I think that we're going to see the continuation of a few things, right? We have seen this, you know, part of the year in review was thinking about the anti-immigrant ballot measures that were attempted to be added to the ballot in Oregon. And we saw organizations like Oregonians for Immigration Reform, which is just a very nasty organization with ties to white nationalism and things like that, we will see them come back. And I suspect that they will come back with better funding and more organization. And so we will be fighting them both in court and on the ground to make sure that they don't get things like English-only languages passed, laws passed here, things that further disenfranchise folks from voting. So I think that's a big one. I think you're going to see Oregon become a hotbed for women's rights. I suspect that you will see, and that's partially because we've done such a good job in Oregon of protecting women's rights to access abortion and other forms of health care. And folks are looking to us as a model. I think you're going to see things around religious liberties and how they intersect, right? Like the using of religion in a negative way to try and discriminate against folks who might be LGBT, LGBTQ,
one catch-all for this is going to be the Department of Justice. Do you foresee any meaningful fight over the confirmation of Jeff Sessions?
Oh, God, I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, I really, like, I just can't imagine a confirmation, you know, the Jeff Sessions confirmation hearings going without a fight. If it does, I mean, I don't know.
And I think,
I won't know what to think about.
No, and I think if it were 50, I think it were 50-50 Senate, or if there were, or I guess you have a Republican vice president, but if you had a Democratic majority in the U.S. Senate, I don't think it'd get confirmed. But now I think it's, you know, maybe a different story. Let's wrap up by looking at thoughts ahead to 2017. Looking ahead to 2017, so Matt DeSantos gave some of his thoughts of things that we need to be watching for. Who wants to go first with their look ahead towards the next year? This is the last show of the year.
Well, you know, I will, because, again, I teach college, and I really believe that we did wake up the millennials with Trump winning. They thought, like, you know, they had the underlying thought, like, well, it's already decided. It's not already decided.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what I hope in 2017, 2018 is that they get engaged and they become a force, because there are more of them than there are baby boomers now, and they can actually change the world, and that's what I'm hoping for.
Dr. Moreland Capuya?
Yeah, I take it back local. We may not be able to control as much of what happens at the federal level as much as we would like to, but we do have an opportunity, and we have the power of a vote. 2018 is coming up, and I think that we have to be very, very thoughtful about who we vote in to represent us, both locally, and that our local and state representations should represent our collective values and goals. And I am hopeful that the lesson is learned is that there is power in the vote, and every vote counts, and hopefully these new motor voter laws will people will realize that power and actually employ it.
Elizabeth Swartow?
Well, I think it's good to remember that, you know, after we vote, that's really just the beginning of the work. And I think that there's so much emphasis during an election year about the platforms of different candidates. And we need to remember that, you know, they don't just magically get into office and then fulfill everything that they said. I think that the public has a very intense responsibility to keep our political leaders accountable. So I guess, you know, what I would encourage is to give offices like mine more work to do. Send more emails and send more letters, and keep your leaders accountable and make sure that they're sticking to those promises and have your ear to the ground.
Tom Johnson?
I think, going forward, think about this. There's a reason they call it a sense of humor, and I actually believe it is a sense. It just like sight, hearing, and that's the way I want to look at comedy going forward, is that we're appealing to a sense, and you can use your eyesight to look at something pretty or interesting. You can use your ears to listen to some music that isn't about important issues just because you like listening to it, but you can also use those senses to hear important things and to see important things. And I want to look at comedy that way, that it may be another route in to something that's difficult to deal with the other senses. So try the sense of humor, and it might just be fun and funny, but it might be a way in to discussion or thought or just reaction later. Hey, that was about something, and it hit me in a different way because it came through that sense.
I'm going to ask a clumsy question. Is there a example you've seen, either of a comedian or a type of a way to do it, that is community building comedy, that is bridge building comedy, that is not only bonding capital growing comedy, right? Not only saying, oh, we generally agree on the following thing and therefore we're going to tease the following thing, mm-hmm. but there's something that jumps over that aids the secret bomb inside.
When we do improvisation, it's very different from other forms of comedy. There's some people who don't even call it comedy. It's something different, because it is not first and foremost about getting the laugh. It's first and foremost about human relationship and connecting, and that idea of yes and, which is how we build our work. But it's yes and is listening and adding what you have to say, which I think is a very important part of communication, and that's what we use to do that. So sometimes the secret bomb can just be I'm talking about doing things like improvisation, not as much as watching them. The audience gets that experience too, but I just saw some people create something simply by listening acknowledging what the other person said and building directly upon it.
We're about to wrap. Last question. Superhero, superhero, you are banking on, you are hoping for, you want us to be watching for, at home, abroad, micro, local, or far away, that you want to be looking for this year. Matt DeSantos, ACLU?
Oh, gosh. You know, this is just totally an opportunity for me to plug my own organization, right? Like, I am watching the ACLU both on a national level and at state affiliates across the country. Oh, you know,
you just say that, myself. I, Matt DeSantos, Shiro.
Sure, yeah, you can watch me. It'll be great.
It'll be great.
All right. So, okay, so Matt DeSantos names himself. Elizabeth Spartow, you.
Yeah, me.
Doesn't have to be a person.
No, it's me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Elizabeth Spartow names herself. Tom Johnson, also yourself?
No, Matt.
Sean Davis?
I'm going to go local, Chloe Udaly, and Margot Black. I want both of them.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Alicia?
Right on.
Dr. Alicia?
Dr. Sharon Myron, and also myself.
All right. Well, I want to say thanks to everybody. This has been the